This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
20 years ago, Darfur was the world's largest hunger crisis, and the world really rallied to respond. But today, it seems that the people of Sudan, even South Sudan and Chad, have been forgotten with everything else that's going on in the world right now.
That's Dr. Chelsea S. Dancona, an assistant professor in political science at the University of South Carolina, on how conflicts in Gaza, Ukraine, and elsewhere have pushed Sudan's bloody war out of the spotlight. Details coming up. Also, tensions between Burundi and Rwanda have spilled into the Basketball Africa League, and the U.S. Treasury has imposed sanctions for alleged money launderers that help the terror group Al-Shabaab. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Sudan's war has shattered millions of lives and created the world's largest displacement crisis. The World Food Program warns, unless the fighting stops, Sudan risks becoming the world's largest hunger crisis. 600,000 people have crossed from Sudan into South Sudan and Chad in the past 10 months, but they face more hunger as these countries have reached their breaking point. Millions of lives and the peace and stability of an entire region are at stake. For more on the humanitarian crisis, VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with Dr. Chelsea S. Dancona, an assistant professor of political science at the University of South Carolina in the United States.
20 years ago, Darfur was the world's largest hunger crisis, and the world really rallied to respond. But today, it seems that the people of Sudan, even South Sudan and Chad, have been forgotten with everything else that is going on in the world right now. So why is the war in Sudan and the humanitarian crisis there not a top priority today?
Absolutely. I think that you sort of hit the nail on the head with the issues of broad geopolitical interest. And so I think what we're facing is we've seen these crises in Ukraine and in with the Israel and Palestine conflict, where much of international attention is being focused elsewhere. And yet, as you say, this is a gigantic humanitarian crisis. This is the largest number of displaced people that we see in the world today in Sudan. So it's really kind of quite puzzling why we're not seeing a high degree of political attention being paid to this situation, even if there has been fairly widespread humanitarian efforts from international organizations. It simply hasn't matched up to sort of the broad international attention, especially, as you said, given the history of the region with Darfur.
And also we see more and more people there fleeing into South Sudan and Chad, and the humanitarian response is really at a breaking point. In just the past 10 months, 600,000 people crossed from Sudan into these countries and really are not able to keep up with the people and the hunger situation. And then we have the aid agencies. They're facing a lot of problems in trying to assist people in the region. Do you know what some of those biggest issues are that aid agencies are facing now there?
Absolutely. I think there are several. At the forefront is just the ability to get to civilians in the midst of all of this violence. And so we have both the armed forces and the RSF paramilitary organization have been perpetrating attacks on civilians and on aid workers as well. So a primary concern has been, how do you administer aid if you cannot keep those who are doing so safe? And of course, you know, people are eager to try, but that challenge needs to be solved even before we get to the broader resource constraints. But then certainly we need to see aid going as well to these neighboring countries. I mean, Chad has attempted to close the border because they are unable to really support these refugee populations. So we need quite a large sort of influx of food, of medical supplies. We're seeing concerns about health and cholera, for example, with water that can't be, you know, kept safe and clean and drinkable. So we need a large amount of water being transported, food being transported, and then again, not only medical supplies, but also medical personnel. So really we need to try and assess the security situation so that those services can be provided, and then double down on the need for large amounts of aid.
And looking at the broader context of this, what is it going to take for the warring parties in Sudan to stop these hostilities?
This is, of course, perhaps the most difficult question. So we face a somewhat unique situation where the leader of the RSF, I think he's orchestrating quite a bit here, out of concern for his own political ambition. And so a ceasefire would, at the minimum, enable us to get the humanitarian aid in the immediate sense, but a long-term political solution is going to have to involve some means of incorporating that RSF into kind of daily life in Sudan. And of course, that's where the issue started. So what we're going to need to see is third-party mediation, the ability to hold both parties accountable here. So again, getting them to halt violence against civilians, but certainly also to agree to some kind of compromise about power sharing. And this is, I think, really vital, not just for getting the conflict to end, but for sort of fostering democracy, fostering long-term economic growth, all of the things that have continued to haunt Sudan in the wake of, you know, these decades of violence.
And that was Dr. Chelsea Istancona, an assistant professor of political science at the University of South Carolina, speaking with my colleague, Kim Lewis. The U.S. Treasury has imposed sanctions on 16 individuals and entities across the Horn of Africa and the Middle East for allegedly laundering money for the Islamist terror group Al-Shabaab. The Treasury said the expansive business network was part of an international fundraising and money laundering web for the Al-Qaeda-linked group based in Somalia. The French news agency AFP says the targets include Dubai-based financial technology company Halil Commodities, which has branches and subsidiaries in Kenya, Somalia, Uganda, and Cyprus. UAE-based Kamat al-Najah General Trading, which served as an important money laundering node in the network, and a Kenyan bus company that supported Al-Shabaab's logistics. The Treasury Department says Al-Shabaab generates over $100 million a year by extorting local businesses and individuals, as well as through the financial support of affiliated business people. Research by United Nations Women shows active resistance to gender equality globally, especially in Africa, where societies continue to be dominated by men. The UN agency says governments across the world have scaled back on financial commitments aimed at protecting women from abuse. Darren Taylor reports.
The United Nations says women and girls living in unstable and conflict-affected countries are most at risk, and their basic rights are constantly eroded. It points out they don't have access to sexual and reproductive health services. There are few women in top positions in African governments, and they get paid much less than men for doing the same jobs. The UN says women get paid 51 cents for every dollar earned by men. On Monday, at the opening of the 68th session of the Commission on the Status of Women, Director of UN Women, Sima Bahuz, said poverty continues to have a female face.
1 in 10 women live in extreme poverty, and at the current rate of progress, as many as 342 million women will still be living in poverty in or by 2030. This makes a mockery of our 2030 agenda. Both poverty and women's financial exclusion is fueled by discriminatory gender norms, which are entrenched in our economic, political, and social systems.
In Soweto, near Johannesburg, community activist Gwen Chabalala says the biggest problem facing women is violence. They're attacked just because they're women, she tells VOA.
From the street level, everybody knows somebody who's abusive. However, before we used to turn a blind eye. Now we are saying all the street committees, the schools, the churches, if you see gender-based violence in your environment, it's on you to do something. So we want to ensure that we prevent it. looking at how we parent our boy children, looking at teaching issues on gender at school level.
Bahuz said gender equality should be a priority for all countries, as it's always the wisest investment to make.
There is no national policy that will not benefit from gender equality. There is no national development policy that will not benefit from gender equality. There is no sustainable development goal that can be attained without gender equality.
Aletta Miller, UN Women Representative for South Africa, says Africa's poor, but most governments have enough money to bring more women into formal economies.
Investing in women's businesses, small businesses, giving women who run small businesses access to capital, access to markets. Security is essential. No one's going to go to work unless it's safe to do so. Care systems. Women in sub-Saharan Africa do 3.4 times the care work at home, caring for children, people with disabilities, the elderly, cooking, cleaning, you know, making sure the household runs. So if we want to engage more women in the economy and in businesses and in work, we have to make sure that there's somewhere for those children, those people with disabilities, for the elderly to be cared for appropriately.
Miller says Africa has a unique opportunity to lead in women's empowerment by getting more women involved in ending conflicts.
And what we know from research is that when you have women involved in peace processes, when you have women involved in responses to conflict, responses to disasters, communities come together and the solutions that they find are better for everybody. More successful peace processes will last longer. The peace will hold when you have women involved.
The South African government has established the Gertrude Schorpe Women Mediators Network. Named after one of the country's anti-apartheid heroes, it trains women from across Africa in conflict resolution. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Angola's foreign minister says Rwanda's President Paul Kagame has agreed to meet Felix Tshisekedi, president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, to discuss security in the volatile Eastern DRC. According to the French news agency AFP, Angola's Tete Antonio told reporters that the date will be set by Angolan President João Lourenço, the African Union's mediator in the dispute between the DRC and Rwanda. The announcement follows a head of state meeting where Rwanda's presidency said they agreed on key steps towards addressing the root causes of the conflict and the need to uphold the Luanda and Nairobi processes to achieve peace and stability in the region. The DRC accuses Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebels, who after 8 years of dormancy took up arms again at the end of 2021 and seized large swaths of the North Kivu region, which borders Rwanda. Kigali denies the charges. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Libyan leaders have agreed on the need to form a unified government that would supervise long-delayed elections. The heads of the East Libya-based parliament, the Tripoli-based High Council of State, and the Presidency Council met in Cairo for talks aimed at bridging gaps to an election. The Arab League said the three leaders agreed to form a technical committee to consider amendments to expand consensus and resolve outstanding issues. Wolfgang Porstey, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
This meeting in Cairo is more or less a follow-up meeting to the informal meeting of about 120 HR and HCS deputies in Tunis at the end of February. Remarkably, 120 members of the two rival parliaments, where they agreed, again, one could say, to establish a new government for Libya in a consensus. But the chairs of both rival parliaments, HR Chair Gila Saleh and HCS Mohamed Dakala, were not there in Tunis. So one could debate how committed both chairs were. Especially Mohamed Takala has been more than reluctant to agree to anything that would lead to a replacement of Abdulhamid Dabeiba, who was allegedly instrumental in getting Takala elected HCS chair. So his loyalty is probably with Dabeiba. And this meeting in Cairo is now the public commitment of Takala, Saleh and Al-Menfi to establish a new government, replacing exactly Prime Minister Dabeiba in Tripoli and Osama Mahamat in Benghazi. And as such, it is really quite important.
The Arab League said in a statement that the three leaders agreed to form a technical committee to consider amendments to expand the consensus and resolve outstanding issues. They also agreed to invite the UN mission in Libya and the international community to support this consensus to make it successful. Would that eventually lead to conducting the long-awaited elections?
Let me stress, this meeting in Cairo is a significant achievement by the Secretary General of the Arab League, Ahmed Abul Gait, and you've perfectly hit the key point of the agreement. There is a technical committee to be established to discuss the open and controversial points. But which are the open and controversial points? Aguila Saleh considers the six election laws that were prepared by an HR-HCS committee last year and, depending on the point of view, agreed also by the HCS, the starting point for any further negotiations. HCS Chair Takala wants to discuss exactly these laws. However, it remains to be seen whether this technical committee will really meet, what kind of issues they are going to deal with, and if an agreement will be reached that is fully supported by HR and HCS and both chairs. In any case, I would say it's still a long way to go before the elections are held. And the best the international community could do now is to give up on the failed Batayin initiative for five-party talks and keep out. Their influence is limited anyway, with the exception of Turkey and Egypt. So the international community should leave the floor to the Arab League.
One of the leaders who attended the meeting in Cairo is the president of the Presidential Council, Mohamed Menfi, who came to power when the Government of National Unity under Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dabeiba was installed through a UN-backed process in 2021. However, Dabeiba has vowed not to cede power to a new government without national elections. What do you make of that?
There are three de facto kingmakers for a prime minister of Libya who can keep Dabeiba in power or have to agree to any new prime minister. Those three are Tripoli and the Misrata militias. They are currently protecting Dabeiba or let them fall in the future. CBL governor Al-Sadiq Al-Kabir, who needs to finance any Libyan government. And Turkey, which ensures and guarantees the security of the government, not only against the eastern strongman Khalifa Haftar, but also against any militias in Tripolitania who might attempt to overthrow Dabeiba. But what is different right now from 2022 is that Dabeiba receives pressure from different directions, including from his hometown Misrata. And there were already some talks with Turkey about prime minister candidates, especially from Misrata, acceptable to Istanbul and Ankara. Altogether, I would say it is increasingly likely that Dabeiba will be replaced before summer.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. The Burundian club Dynamo has forfeited its participation in the Men's Basketball Africa League because of its refusal to wear a Visit Rwanda logo on its uniform. For more details, let's listen to a discussion between my VOA colleagues, Mokbilia Baro and Eddie Ruema.
On this segment today, I have with me my colleague, Eddie Ruema. Eddie, thanks for being on the show with me today.
Thank you for having me, Mokbil.
Let's get into this very interesting news about the Dynamo Basketball Club from Burundi and their unfortunate exit in the BAL Kalahari Conference. Can you talk to me about that?
Unfortunately, Dynamo of Burundi has exited the Basketball African League Season 4 of a sponsor logo dispute. The dispute is about the logo of Visit Rwanda. As you may know, that Rwanda for many years has been one of the majority or major sponsors of Basketball Africa League. So because currently Rwanda and Burundi have some political issues, so the government of Burundi pressured Dynamo Basketball Club not to wear the jerseys with the logos, or if they are to play, to cover the logo. So that is how the dispute started during the first game, where Dynamo played with Cape Town Tigers. Unfortunately enough, they were able to win that game. But after the game the following day, they were forfeited. And now they were supposed to play today again against Petro de Luanda. That game was also forfeited, and now they're out of the league, which is very, very unfortunate. It's been a very good team. I can say that the dreams of these young, talented players have been crushed. They were so excited to compete and put Burundi on the map. The sport in Burundi had started getting on the Cornetto and world spotlight, and I surely don't understand what the government of Burundi was trying to prove. It's not good for the country, it's not good for BAL, and for sure it's not good for the continent.
Absolutely. Eddie, just going off on that same point, interestingly enough, the Dynamo Basketball Club knew that they had to wear this Visit Rwanda logo. As seasons past, teams have worn this as well. So why do you think the Burundian government or whomever decided to tell the team that they shouldn't wear it once the competition started?
I don't know, because like you say, Dynamo, before they went into the Basketball Africa League, you remember that they also had to do the road to BAL. So they knew the rules of the game. They knew that at the end of the day, they were going to wear Visit Rwanda. They knew that they were going to be transported by Rwanda Air from Burundi to South Africa, where they were supposed to be playing in the Kalahari Conference. But because of the politics that are going on and the government trying to get involved in sports, that is what is affecting this team. It's very unfortunate. It's a very young team. For example, you had players, like Brighton Hobbs, Israel Otubo, and Dien Deng, who combined scored almost 60 points during the first game. They had shown they had the potential after their first win against the home team, Cape Town Tigers, and most people were expecting them to even do much better than what they had done. So it is very unfortunate.
Yes, absolutely. Lastly, as you mentioned, those players, what does that mean for the players now moving forward? How are the players feeling? I know Brighton Hobbs, the captain, made a statement. I'm sure he's not feeling too good or too happy about this situation.
Yeah, most of the players have said and they have repeated what we're talking about. They knew all this before they went into the competition. The government knew about it. We don't know yet the extent at which these the punishments are going to come, but we hear that Burundi must be suspended from participating in any basketball competition for 5 years. We hear that during the first game they were supposed to be fined $50,000, and then later after the Federation of Burundi Basketball Federation is likely to be fined $500,000, and this will also affect players. I don't know whether it's going to affect foreign players like Brighton Hobbs, Israel Otubo, Dien Deng, and the other Senegalese. But for the local talents, for sure, this is going to hit hard on them.
Thank you so much for the insight, Eddie. Appreciate you.
All right, bro.
That was VOA's Mokbilia Baro and Eddie Ruema discussing Burundian club Dynamo's forfeiture in the Men's Basketball Africa League. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.